Hello everyone and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
I don't think anyone can doubt our commitment to transition our company.
A rare and exclusive interview with the head of BP. I asked CEO Bernard Looney about his promise that the fossil fuel giant can be part of the solution to climate change.
And this is his most flagrant example of a stolen election as we have ever seen, and the world needs to know that.
Spotlight on Nicaragua. U.S. Congresswoman Maria Elvira Salazar joins me to up the pressure on power-hungry President Daniel Ortega. Plus,
anytime the police talk to each other, it's just gibberish. 3 Victor, 2 David, 2 David, 2 Victor.
The imperfect messenger. Comedian Roy Wood Jr. talks to Hari Srinivasan about police reform and bringing light to society's most serious issues. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. Winter is coming to the Northern Hemisphere, and with soaring energy prices and fears of inflation, homeowners are bracing for what might be ahead, big heating bills. As the global economy revs back up, its reliance on fossil fuels has become crystal clear. This as negotiators continue to try to hammer out climate pledges at the COP26 summit in Glasgow. The former US President Barack Obama flew over to Scotland and he told the audience that time is really running out now.
Here in Glasgow, we see the promise of further progress. What is also true is that collectively and individually, we are still falling short. We have not done nearly enough to address this crisis. We are going to have to do more. And whether that happens or not, to a large degree, is going to depend on you.
And while some meaningful pledges have been made at COP this year, there's still no consensus on how to achieve the summit's number one goal, which is limiting the planet's warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. My first guest tonight is at the center of all of this. He is Bernard Looney, the CEO of BP, which has pledged to become a net zero company by 2050 or sooner. I asked him how. Bernard Looney, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
So how bad did you feel about not being or being disinvited from COP26? You and the other oil giant leaders were just not invited.
Well, look, I think, Christiane, as you well know, I think there's a lot of people in society who would see a company like ours being part of the problem rather than being a part of the solution. Mm-hmm. And I understand that feeling, and therefore, at the end of the day, I think it would have been in many ways, a distraction for me to be there. Some of my team was there. I participated virtually. But I do think it speaks to this whole piece about having a seat at the table and whether indeed companies like BP, who have a net zero ambition, who have near-term targets, who are willing to be transparent and are transparent, who are willing to be held to account, actually need to be at the table, I believe, to help the world make this transition.
Run through quickly and briefly, so I give you a chance to put your transition policies to me and to our viewers.
Well, in February of last year, we laid out a new purpose for BP. We laid out a new strategy 6 months later. And our strategy is to go from what we've been doing for 112 years, which is being an international oil company, to move from that to being an integrated energy company. And an integrated energy company is a company whose purpose is to give society what it wants and needs. And what it wants and needs is clean, reliable, and affordable energy. And that's our strategy. Ever since that, we've been working hard on enacting that strategy. This is not a light switch. We don't turn a 112-year-old company on its head overnight. But we've carried out the biggest restructuring in our history. We've entered offshore wind in the largest and fastest growing markets in the world, in the US and the UK. We're involved in hydrogen. We're doubling down on electrification. We're doing all of the things that a company of ours needs to do to be part of the solution, and in doing so, create enormous value for our shareholders.
How long ago did you say you put this out?
February 2020.
Okay, so that's not very long ago, right? And we have been living in an existential crisis for a lot longer than that. Do you understand, do you feel people's pain, to quote former President Clinton? Do you get the anxiety of our young people who don't even see a future for them? You know, they're really anxious right now.
So I think the first thing is to say is that I do get it. And I get it because I spent the first 4 or 5 months before I took up the role going around, listening, talking to NGOs, talking to shareholders, listening to different forms of society, listening to an activist who was particularly influential in my thinking. She was fantastic.
What did she change?
Well, I think she helped me realize things like she came to our annual general meeting and she said, you know, I look around and it looks like I'm at a renewables company. You're an oil and gas company. And the reality is, Christiane, that the world needs companies like ours to transition. You simply cannot build and scale enough new green companies fast enough. 70% of the world's emissions come from companies and sectors like ours. Unless we transition, the world's not going to transition.
So basically you're saying the idea of getting rid of oil and gas anytime soon is pie in the sky.
Every single scenario that I've seen, including the IEA's net zero scenario for 2050, has oil and gas still in the system. In that scenario, 20 million barrels a day in 2050. The reality
compared is, to?
Compared to about 100 million today. Mm-hmm. So our strategy is to lean in that direction. We are the only company that I'm aware of who has an objective. Having spent 112 years trying to grow production, we're going to take our production down by 40% this decade. Show me any company that is doing that. We're going to bring our gigawatt pipeline. We've got 23 gigawatts. A year ago, we had 10. We had nothing in offshore wind a year ago. Today, we have 3.7 gigawatts. We've increased the number of charge points in electrification by 35% in the space of a year. We are all in. And it's not just because society wants us to do this and needs us to do this. It's because our employees want us to do it. They're part of this equation too. And indeed our shareholders, because trillions of dollars are going to get spent rewiring and replumbing the Earth's energy system. And we believe, because of what we've been doing, we're one of the few companies that it can actually help solve this complex problem and give shareholders a real return on their investment at the same time as doing good for the world.
Some of the activists and experts on this say that they expected companies like yours to be the industry leaders on renewables, right? That had it been 15 years ago, even 10 years ago, and I think even BP 20 years ago, drew back from it because of financial pressure. Do you think that was a mistake? I've heard other, like the head of Shell and others saying that that was a mistake, like wind. They dumped wind 15 years ago, and now they're getting back into it, but things could have really been different.
Well, look, we can look back or we can look at where we are today.
No, but I want to know, isn't that a real pressure that you can do things or say things, but then under huge, whether it's lobbyists, whether it's shareholders, whether it's financial, step back?
You can't defy gravity. Society wants and needs cleaner, reliable, and affordable energy. BP is one of the few companies, I believe, that can knit together what is a very complex system now. It used to be coal, then it was oil. Now it's very different, Christiane. It's solar, wind, it's natural gas, it's nuclear, it's hydro. Somebody has to put those things together because a customer doesn't want to have to deal with these different forms of energy. And I am convinced that as we execute on our strategy, step by step, day by day, I understand why people feel like they do. I understand that. I always say to our people, put ourselves in their shoes. Hold up a mirror. Look at ourselves first. So I get it. And therefore, I'm not going to try and convince anybody by my words. You're going to have to judge by our actions, quarter on quarter, day on day. And some of the things that I've just talked about that we're doing, I think it's very hard to refute that we're not all in on making this transition happen in a way that's good for society and in a way that's good for our shareholders.
So that's nice to hear. As you know, the American head of BP America and the other giants were in Congress about a week to 10 days ago, called by Ro Khanna and the committee there, to try to figure out why you all have spent so long, decades, lobbying and spending hundreds of millions, if not billions, over the years to deny the climate science, to lobby government, to keep getting the subsidies, and to basically push back against the very things that you're saying right now. When people accuse you of greenwashing, they say, then why do you support and fund the industry lobbyists, the API, for instance, American Petroleum Institute? And at the congressional hearing, not one of the leaders would disassociate themselves from this lobbying group. Not one of them. How are people, ordinary people, meant to get beyond what you're saying and try to figure out whether you're serious if you keep funding these very powerful lobbying groups?
So I would say a couple of things to that. And the first thing I would say is around greenwashing, and you know this individual well, John Brown, in 1997,
the former chief executive
of BP, mm-hmm. was the first industry executive that I know of to publicly acknowledge at a speech in Stanford in 1997 that there is indeed a link between human activity and global warming. So I think BP's track record in the matter of acknowledging the science is very, very clear, and in fact invested billions and billions of dollars in the period of 2000 to 2010, which in many ways was ahead of its time and had to be written off because it was simply too early. So I look back at that and I say, I think it's hard to say that we as a company have somehow been not behind the science. We were the first, I would argue, in 1997 to acknowledge it and do so publicly.
But you do acknowledge that the lobbying groups and other giants have been questioning the science.
So I'm not here to speak for
other companies. I understand, but it's an industry problem.
In terms of the specific organization that you talk about, so since I took over last year, we have been issuing a report that we will issue, I think, every 2 years mm-hmm. that looks at all of our trade associations. And like everything in life, the API being one of them, there are some where we're fully aligned in terms of policies, and there are some where we are partially aligned, and there are some where we are not aligned at all. Where we are not aligned at all, Christiane, we have left. And we've left, I think, three organizations in the last mm-hmm. Couple of years. And I think it's clear in that report that we are partially aligned with the API. Some of the things that they do is not about lobbying. They actually develop safety standards for the entire industry. I think it's important that we would be partaking in that. I think that's important. And in terms of lobbying, where we disagree with them, we're public when we disagree.
So on electric vehicles and all that, you've just announced a partnership last month with BMW Daimler on charging stations in Europe. You said, we intend to double down on and grow, particularly here in Europe, particularly in China, and looking at the United States. And yet, in February, API, who you're just describing, released a report called Reasons to Rethink a Rushed EV Transition. And its president and CEO said, electric vehicle technologies may appear to offer clear-cut solutions to modern challenges, but government action to limit America's transportation choice would leave everyday drivers high and dry. So you help fund this organization. How does it square with what you started our interview by saying, that you're investing in electric and all these other important things?
We absolutely believe in electrification. We're big investors in it. We back it. I think, in my own view, the electrification of transport for you and I, mm-hmm. that battle has been won. It's been won by electrification, and we're investing in it in the countries that you say so. I also told you that it's not everywhere that we agree with the API on. And clearly on electrification, we are pro-electrification. Here in the UK, we lobbied for the ban on the internal combustion engine by 2030. So there are areas of difference. And that's why in our report, we're very clear that we are partially aligned. But we believe, Christiane, just like I would argue to an investor in BP, better be inside and influencing than outside. That's the same argument that I would make with an investor. An investor has a choice. You can divest from BP. It's a one-time action. You're done. Mm-hmm. If you stay involved, you can challenge, you can influence, you can engage, and you can help the world transition, because the world needs companies.
But do you
like
think the API is helping the world transition? You're talking about investors in your company. I understand what you're saying. But these are people who you're paying to lobby, I mean, even against methane.
We've been very clear. So I think what I've said is the following. Number one, the API does much more than lobbying. It's a massive safety standards organization. That is a key reason why we are a member.
Okay, so would you tell them then to stop this kind of lobbying and confusing people
today,
and lying about science?
Today, the API has a climate plan. BP and other companies that are like-minded have been a part of helping the API get to a place where it has a carbon plan, a climate plan. And you mentioned methane. On the matter of methane, we've been very public. We've been very public over the last 18 months, if you look at any of our releases in the United States, that we are pro the regulation of methane. We are pro it being at a federal level. And that is, by definition, not always aligned with a position that the API might take. We're not trying to hide anything here. We're saying that we are partially aligned. There are some areas we're fully aligned. There are some areas that we are not.
How many years or decades do you see for oil and gas ahead?
Well, don't look at what I say. Look at the IEA. The IEA, in the most ambitious...
That's the International Energy Agency.
Fatih Birol, very learned, very huge organization. Even in their net zero scenario, which does achieve 1.5 degrees, there's still 20 million barrels of oil a day in the system in 2050. That's down from 100 today. And in the other scenarios, the numbers are much bigger than that. The question for the world is, what is our objective? Mm-hmm. What is our objective? Is it positions against oil or against natural gas? Or what are we actually trying to achieve? What we're trying to achieve, I think we'd all agree, we want to get emissions down. And we need to employ every single technology possible to make our energy cleaner. That doesn't mean that it's necessarily going to be 100% clean overnight. But today, if we could have natural gas being burned instead of coal, that would be a positive thing. And yet some people are quite, you know, well, no, that's unacceptable. Well, I think Mark Carney says, let's start every meeting with saying, what's our objective? Our objective is to drive emissions down. So let's get coal onto natural gas. Then you mentioned CCS. Then over time, let's capture the carbon from the natural gas and store it. All of these technologies are going to be part of the solution. There is no one single bullet here. If it were, it would have been done already.
I think people will want to hear, you know, your honest opinion on my final question. You clearly are saying that you want to be on the right side of history. And you're also saying it's hard. Do you then wish that your predecessors and this industry, when the science was clear and when the alarm bells were being rung very loudly a decade ago, 2 decades ago, had started as urgently as you're speaking right now?
Well, I think BP is a very good case study in this regard. John Brown, our former CEO, was the first industry executive in 1997 to publicly acknowledge this. We then put in place a series of plans to reduce our emissions. He established an environmental trading scheme within the company. We invested $10 billion in renewables. The reality is we were too early. The policies weren't there. The world wasn't ready. And we ended up writing off $8, $9 billion of those investments. So absolutely, we have done a lot. Importantly, we have learned a lot. And what I can tell you is what I'm responsible for and accountable for today is what we're doing now. And we are all in. And I think all of the things that we are doing and all of the things we did in the last 18 months, it's very, very difficult, I think, objectively, to say that we are not all in on trying to make this work. I said it's hard. My job is not to tell anyone that this is hard. My job is to say it's hard and we're going to help figure it out, because that's what our role is and that's what our employees want. And I think that's what society ultimately expects of us.
We'll be back with you in a year from now.
I hope so. Thank you.
Bernard Looney, thank you very much for joining
us. Thanks for having me on. Thank you.
So now let's go to the COP26 summit in Glasgow. A new report from the environmental group Global Witness found the fossil fuel industry has more lobbyists there than any national delegation. Phil Black has been covering the event since it started last week, and he's joining me now. So, Phil Black, you heard what Bernard Looney promised and what he was telling me from headquarters in London. There seems, though, to be a generational disconnect, because there where you are and where I was last week, you can see young people just at their wits' end, just emotionally and factually just unable to process what they feel is a too slow transition. What are you feeling and hearing now into the second week at COP on this issue?
Well, Christiane, I think there are some people here who are aware that the former BP CEO John Brown acknowledged the science back in the 90s, but that was a long time ago. And as you pointed out through that interview, not a lot has changed, or not, certainly not enough has changed. Overwhelmingly, there is a perception here that fossil fuel industries have some pretty powerful motivations for not moving too quickly on the transition. Barack Obama spoke about this today when he addressed some delegates here, when he talked about a lot of the opposition to climate policies coming from fossil fuel industries, because, in his words, they are out to make a buck. And you touched on the fact that someone looked at the accreditation list, did some counting, and worked out that there are more people here connected to fossil fuel companies than to any single country delegation, around 500 people. So taking all of this together, I think it's absolutely fair to say there remains a perception that these companies, just like the small island countries, are in something of an existential battle. They're just often better resourced. Christiane.
So we talked, you just talked about President Obama, and the theme today, let me read it, is adaptation, loss and damage. And he said again what many leaders have said and what many have said in their interviews with us, that it really is up to the wealthy nations to help the less developed nations, the wealthy nations, which are the biggest emitters, to the less developed nations, which barely emit anything. Is there a feeling that there is a substantial and adequate pledge of money and resources from the wealthy to the less developed who really need it to transition?
This is a really fraught issue, Christiane, and it's quite complex, and it talks about money for a bunch of different intentions. Fundamentally, yes, built into this process is the moral understanding that rich countries have a responsibility to help poor countries who didn't create the problem and who often stand the most to lose from it because they are vulnerable and they can't spend their way through it. We know it's had a lot of discussion, the fact that rich countries pledged more than 10 years ago to mobilize $100 billion a year to help poor countries. That was supposed to happen by 2020. They've missed that. It's probably not going to happen here again. We're still talking about that being delivered to the right amount, maybe 2022, maybe 2023. That does erode trust among those poorer, those developing countries. And we now have, on top of that, some of the most vulnerable countries calling for loss and damage payments, essentially reparations for the impacts of climate change they believe they are already experiencing and will be experiencing in the near term. There has been an acknowledgement of that feeling and that desire, and it is a very sensitive issue. But it would seem at the moment rich countries aren't prepared to make a lot of progress on that point. But it's going to be really sensitive and delicate in these final days, because in this consensus-style negotiation, it cannot be ignored. It can't be shut down. There is going to be have to be a formal acknowledgement of that issue come the end of the talks, pointing to an ongoing process for continuing that discussion. But it's crucial because it all ties into trust and solidarity. And if you don't get that right, then there is absolutely an understanding here that the system falls over.
Well, we saw some incredible pictures and some incredible scene of the foreign minister of the island state of Tuvalu standing knee-deep in water to try to make this point that you've just been talking about. And it appears that Scotland is the only, I know it's the host country, but it's not exactly a massive country with a massive economy. It's the only country that has agreed to pay compensation for the kind of damage that we've just been talking about. And just finally, related to this, obviously, the main goal is to try to keep the idea of 1.5 degrees warming, that should be the limit, keep that idea alive. Is that idea alive? What is the talk about that sort of iconic number right now?
I think you could say it's in trouble. We know that it is not going to be secured at this conference. The emissions targets that have been put on the table are just simply nowhere close enough to being adequate to ensuring that goal stays within reach. There will be a real push in these final days to try and close the gaps, and there might be some progress, but it will not be enough. We will not see some of the big polluting countries which are reluctant to make big cuts this decade. We're talking about Australia, Brazil, China, Russia. These countries are unlikely to move significantly in the next few days, certainly not enough to secure the goal. So therefore the next point becomes, well, how do we revisit this again? Because under the Paris Agreement, it is supposed to be reviewed every 5 years. There is absolutely a belief here that we can't wait another 5 years. We don't have enough time. So there will also be a push in these final days to try and establish a review at more regular intervals, or at shorter intervals, perhaps 2 years, perhaps even a year, and in the hope that that sort of urgency will ramp up the ambition and the pressure more quickly. But really securing that process in many ways will determine the success or failure of this conference and whether or not that crucial 1.5 figure does indeed stay alive and could perhaps be achievable within the coming years. Christian.
Phil, thank you. That is really good insight from COP26 in Glasgow. Thanks so much for joining us. And now we're going to turn to Central America and an election that is being called a total fraud and a sham. After jailing his rivals and dozens of critics, Nicaragua's President Daniel Ortega and his vice president, who is his wife, look set to be re-elected for a fourth term, with more than 70% of Sunday's vote. Just days before the election, the U.S. House of Representatives passed the RENESA Act, calling for tougher sanctions on the regime. The Florida Republican Congresswoman Maria Elvira Salazar was one of the sponsors of that legislation, and she is joining me now from Tampa, Florida. Congresswoman, welcome to the program, and we are going to get to Nicaragua. But because of our talk and our, you know, important focus on climate, I want to ask you about the bipartisan infrastructure bill that was just passed by Congress, Biden's bill. It's obviously watered down, but you did not vote for it. Why not?
Well, thank you for the opportunity. And before I answer your question, I just wanted to thank you very much for inviting me to your show. When I was a news reporter like you were one of the models, and I am privileged to be able to talk to you. And now let me explain to you why I voted against it. Because that immigration bill has been a trade-off for the Democrats between infrastructure and socialism. They're saying that they want to transform this country, that this is going to be a transformational bill. And indeed, they are going to transform the United States, and that founding spirit that created the United States is going to be shot. And that is the reason why I voted against this bill, because there has been a trade-off between infrastructure and socialism, and I cannot allow that. Number two, even more importantly, that bill, half of the bill, or 25%, I should say, is going to be paid by the debt, is not covered. Number three, half of the bill is only half of the bill is going to what you and I know as traditional infrastructure. The rest is very questionable. That bill, at this moment, does not resolve the number one problem the average American family is facing, inflation, higher eggs, higher milk, higher gas prices. So what we need to do is look for the money that's available. Florida has $6 billion in the Treasury in Tallahassee. We could be using that money for transforming, for infrastructure. But the problem is not so much the reconciliation bill that is coming up next, according to Nancy Pelosi, or the infrastructure. What we're seeing here is that the Democratic Party is trying to transform the founding spirit of the United States.
Okay, can I just stop you there? I mean, I'm hearing what you're saying, and you are portraying some really urgent needs in the country, such as infrastructure, such as even helping, you know, your own district in Florida, as a fundamental effort to transform the whole idea of the United States. The truth is that when we hear us over here in Europe, the word socialism coming out of the United States, we just throw up our hands because it's so far from that, that it's just a slogan. What I want to ask you then, because of what we've been discussing, is do you not believe that climate the crisis affects your district and your part of the world. Are you not concerned about that?
I am very concerned, and I have one of the longest coasts in the state of Florida, District 27. Yeah. I have Biscayne Bay, but I'm not discussing that. Obviously, that we have to take care of the sea level rising and the climate change. Absolutely. But when you say that socialism is a slogan, I come from a district that has felt socialism on their skin. Socialism is a nefarious ideology, and unfortunately, according to my view and to my constituents and my voters, socialism has penetrated the Democratic Party, and you're seeing it. They're radicals. They belong to an organization called the Democratic Socialist Organization of America, and they are Marxists. And Marxism only means three things: oppression, repression, and exile.
We're going to get to this regarding Nicaragua, but you know as well as I do, or probably better than I do, because you're no longer a journalist, you're actually a congresswoman who can actually do things, and facts matter, congresswoman, that government spending is not socialism. But beyond that, let us just play what President Obama said about the climate crisis, which doesn't recognize the words socialism, Marxism, or even Democrat and Republican. It's about all of us, all of humanity. Here's what he said.
It doesn't matter if you're a Republican or a Democrat, if your Florida house is flooded by rising seas, or your crops fail in the Dakotas, or your California house is burning down. Nature, physics, science do not care about party affiliation.
So I guess I just want to, I mean, do you agree with that, that this is a physical, factual, scientific issue that doesn't care about parties or ideologies? And particularly when we're going to talk right now about Nicaragua, this pressure, among many others, of climate catastrophe is also causing people to come into the United States and mass migration movements.
I am not questioning that climate change is something that we have to address. And I just told you, I'm in Florida 27. Biscayne Bay is part of my district. And I know that we have to take care of it and that we have to invest resources. And Miami Beach has a major problem with sea level rising and North Bay Village. I understand what you're telling me. But I do believe that you take care of that through other means, through conservative means. I'm not saying that you ignore it. Absolutely. Absolutely. I understand that the fish are not Republicans, Democrats, or independent, that the fauna, we need to preserve our natural resources. And Florida, tourism is the economy. Economy is tourism, and the economy, tourism is climate change. I don't disagree. What I'm saying is that when you ask me about infrastructure and about the reconciliation bill that is coming right after, all I'm saying is that those two bills, or specifically the reconciliation bill that the Dems call the human infrastructure, what we're doing in reality is that we are changing the American psyche. We're changing the corroding the founding spirit of this country, which is to wake up in the morning, take risks, be responsible for your own actions, and not make God the government or make government God. That's what I'm saying. And when you tell me about Nicaragua,
let's go to Nicaragua. So the government, this administration, has called the election, which we said over the weekend, a sham pantomime election. Is the administration's response, and I will give you a bit, I'll read some in a minute, but is the response enough? What are you looking for, having helped pass that legislation about election reform and the like in Nicaragua?
It's embarrassing. It's embarrassing what the State Department is doing in Central America. But not only Nicaragua, in Venezuela, in Cuba, all over Latin America. And why do I say it's embarrassing? I have hundreds of thousands of Nicaraguans who live in District Number 27. I was the Central American bureau chief while you were in the Middle East. I was covering the Reagan war between the Sandinistas and the Contras. I know the Nicaraguans very well. Could you imagine what it is that the whole political capital that President Ronald Reagan invested in Central America, specifically against the Sandinistas, that we are back in square one. That once again, Daniel Ortega, in the eyes of the State Department, stole not only last night's election, but stole the country. Seven of the presidential contenders are in a dungeon. They have been there for more than 5 months. How do I know? Because one of them, Arturo Cruz, was my first husband, one of the leaders of the Contra. How could you be in jail just because you're running as a presidential contender because you want democracy in your country? That's Daniel Ortega and the Sandinistas. But where is the State Department? Where is the beacon of hope, which is this country, the United States? They have been begging, beseeching, calling my office, saying, why don't you do something? So we passed the Renacer Act. Thank God that President Biden is saying that he is going to sign it. And what is that going to be sending, Christiane? Is going to be sending the message to Ortega, late and pretty weak message, but nonetheless is there, that you cannot go to Paris or to Italy or to Miami and enjoy the fruits of what you stole from the national treasury. But still, we have not sent the message that the United States need to be sending to that type of dictators in our backyard, that you cannot be stealing elections just like that in broad daylight.
Let me ask you something that I touched on before, immigration, because clearly this all has an impact. The people who can't live under that regime in Nicaragua are going to want to leave it. More than 100,000 yes. Nicaraguans are seeking refuge, as you know, primarily right now in Costa Rica, and many of them are likely to try to come to your country, to the United States. So should the U.S. welcome these Nicaraguans who are fleeing this repressive regime? What is your view on that?
It's a very complicated topic, because if you are Nicaraguan, obviously I would pack up my kids and everything that I own and I would come up north, because the gringos, the Yankees, are going to treat me a lot better than my own compatriots. So that's what's happening. But at the same time, we're in a situation where we cannot be allowing the whole world to come. So that's why I go back to Ronald Reagan. He had a right. He would fight the Sandinistas with everything he had. Diplomatically speaking, he was the guy who forced the Sandinistas to give elections in 1989, and that's why Violeta Barrios de Chamorro was able to win. So Reagan had a right. And second, let's invite the American companies to go and set up shop in Central America, give tax breaks, tax incentives, whatever it takes.
So not sanctions.
Jobs from China. Well, sanctions, we have sanctions, but you were asking me about the immigration reform. Yeah. And then that's another problem that we have as Americans. We need to reform the immigration system that we have. It's in shambles. It's another embarrassment. But this is for the United States. It's time after Reagan to have an immigration reform law.
Wish we had more time. Yeah. Congresswoman Salazar, thank you for joining us. And sticking with politics now, but with some much-needed comic relief inserted, stand-up Roy Wood Jr. is best known as a correspondent for The Daily Show with Trevor Noah, whose satire never dodges the tough topics. And his new hour-long special for Comedy Central is no exception. It's called Imperfect Messenger, and it tackles everything from race and police reform to mass shootings and celebrity activism. Here he is talking to Hari Srinivasan.
Christiane, thanks. Roy Wood Jr., thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you all for having me.
All right. So, when I was watching it, I could almost feel the heat from the TV. I mean, this is fresh from the oven, so to speak. I have never heard of a comedy special being done so close. I mean, we're talking now and it's less than a month old. How did that happen?
The idea at the time, back in February, when we were kind of figuring out, okay, I know I should have the material ready by October.
Yeah.
But when do we want to air it? And at that time in February, the news cycle was turning over fast. And my stand-up isn't introspective. It's about the world around us. So the world changes. Like, I'm liable to have a joke about the Delta variant, and then we've moved on to Lambda, Echo, Charlie, Omega, Zeta. So I, at no point did I want this material to feel out of touch.
Yeah.
So I wanted to do, and I had to give hats off to Comedy Central and the production company for being able to make this turn happen. I mean, there's always some hiccups and things like that, but it was important to me to have material that was comedy is at its best when it is reflective of the time we are currently in.
I want to play one of the clips that you talk about a little bit. And the first clip here is something that we really haven't thought about when it comes to police reform. Let's take a look at the ways that police speak to each other.
I got two cops in my family, which is kind of like saying some of my best friends are black. What I do? I got two cops in my family. Chicago suburb and a Mississippi State trooper. We get to talking about everything that's going on, man. And I was trying to explain to them, it's base level shit the police could be doing. We ain't talking legislation and policy, just base level shit you could do to help build a bridge, to make things a little better. First thing the police need to do, this one thing I think the police should start doing. Stop talking in code on the radio. Use regular words. Why y'all talking all these abbreviations and shit? Why are you keeping secrets? Secrets is what got you in trouble all this time. Stop keeping secrets. You ain't in Iraq. You ain't giving away your position to the enemy. Use regular work. You're in front of the Walgreens. I can see you. Everybody can see you. But that ain't what the police do. You heard the police talk to each other on the radio? This is gibberish. Anytime the police talk to each other, it's just gibberish. 3 Victor, 2 David, 2 David, 2 Victor. Come on. And we be watching the police in the grocery store. They see us looking at the radio. The police love to play it off, act like they understood what dispatch was talking about. 3 Adam David, 3 Adam David, 3 Adam, respond code, 2 Victor, 3 Victor, 10 4 Victor. You don't know what she just said. Stop around. You don't know what she just said to you. You wonder why the police show up and shoot the wrong person.
So I got to ask, with these two officers in your family, what's the Thanksgiving table like?
It's fine. We'll start there. Just a base level statement. It's fine. It's all love. But there are two different mile markers in their career. You know, one is a couple years from retirement, while the other one is just starting to hit a stride and get the promotions and, you know, trying to head towards lieutenant. We talk a lot about what's going on. You know, we don't get into a lot of the nuance, but I think it's helped round out my view on policing a little bit to have two cops in my family, to be able to sit and listen to their stories of what they deal with, because I know their intentions to be pure. And there's definitely a lot of influences that keep them from doing everything. And I think that's the part that I think where policing is, I don't want to say misunderstood, but there is a lot of nuance that we aren't privy to as civilians to what that job is like and what cops have to do and what they're also up against to a larger degree from the government and politicians.
What do you think the structural barrier is? I mean, right now you had the George Floyd, the Justice and Policing Act that didn't move, the John Lewis Voting Rights Act that stuck.
I think that there has to be more appeal to getting politicians in place. You know, I sometimes feel like I don't know if we can leave righteousness up to the American voter. I don't know if a policy is solely rooted in the American people voting on it. I don't know, but I do trust that politicians there are more level-headed politicians than not. And finding those and getting those in office, and even centrist. Like, I'm not even talking about just everything's got to be blue or else it's going to be crazy. But just, you don't need anybody that's just going, the aliens are coming and let's go to death. Like, you have to remember that the people we're expecting to vote on making this country a better place are the same people who went to Dallas, Texas to wait and see if John F. Kennedy's dead body was going to appear at the assassination site so that he could take the presidency back from Joe Biden. This is a fact. Everything I just said is true. So you're going to be hard pressed to speak logic into people sometimes. And so it's almost like you need it's almost a situation where you need more responsible parents to come in and straighten out the kids. You know, I do think that there is a high degree of performative wokeness in this country. There's a lot of people wearing shirts But how you vote? Show me your ballot. Take a picture of that. Put that on your shirt. If you want to, like we talking allyship, like that's the stuff that, you know, we can be whatever we want to be out here in the world. But when you get into that voting booth, that's who you really are. And the fact that these acts have stalled and the fact that certain laws didn't pass after huge monumental movements, and we are having a moment, and this country is finally reckoning with this race. Is it though? Is it?
We just had an election where there are members now elected into state offices, school boards, that were at the January 6th riot. They're not in prison. They've won the confidence of their neighbors.
Yes, and these are the parents showing up to the school meetings to make sure XYZ is not enforced. Oh, we had a women's march. I think we made some progress. I think they heard us. Texas didn't hear you. So that becomes this place where, you know, are our voices enough? Do we need better politicians in office to help change this? But, oh, good luck getting them in office, because North Carolina's gerrymandering. Like, they got it down to the point where they could split a building into two different districts. What side of the hallway do Black people work on? All right, that's not in my district. I got to give it up to them, man. Racism is getting craftier and craftier, though.
Pre-pandemic, maybe Me Too or post-Me Too, there was, I don't know, you want to call it accountability culture, cancel culture. I'm wondering where you think about that. I mean, should the standards be different for artists? Should a Roy Wood Jr. or a Dave Chappelle be able to say things in a satirical form or a humorous way that shouldn't be the same as what a CEO does when they're sitting at their desk and talking to their employees?
I think that performers should be given certain guardrails. And I think what's happened, in my opinion, is that, you know, we're just in a time now where people, members of marginalized communities, they're like, I don't like that joke. I don't want to hear that. You know what? I'm going to type something real quick to let everybody know I don't like that. And I think that's the only difference between now and the 60s or the 70s. But you also had a time where comedians were being arrested. Comedians were being taken to jail for the things that they were saying. To me, that's cancel culture. What's happening right now, in my opinion, with comedy, it's just people having an opinion. All right, you did a college show, them college kids didn't want to hear that edgy joke that would have flown in 1995. They don't want to hear it. So they have a right to that. So you can adjust to the market, or you can perform solely to people who like that type of humor. And more often, those people are outside of the mainstream, and it's not going to be on TV, and you're going to have opportunities taken away from you from groups and entities that care about the opinions of others, if not for morality, solely for the fiscal purposes of it. And to me, that's the bigger issue when we get into a lot of the righteousness that comes from canceling someone and believing that a corporation actually cares about your ideals. I don't believe for one moment that most of these companies care about that. These companies care about making money. And if something controversial makes them a little bit of money, they're going to do it. Unless enough people on the other side go wrong, 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 and the company doesn't want to look bad because that's bad for the stock price. So, hey, you know what? We've heard your cries, and we've decided to take that wrongful thing off the platform. I mean, there's a lot of hypocrisy, you know, in that.
You've got a funny bit in the special about allyship, and again in the sort of arena of police reform, what police could do. Let's take a look at that clip.
The other thing the police could do, this would really build a bridge. Every cop in this country, once a month, let it go. I'm serious. Not every day, not every shift, not every week, but just once a month, just let it go. And not for every crime. I'm not saying for all crime. There's certain crimes that have to be permanent, like the murder, the ATF, SVU. Like, you keep the hits. you know, the major crime, you still got to go to jail for that. But a lot of crime that's out there that cops take us to jail for, you ain't got to take me to jail for this, man. Come on, dog. Just because it's a crime don't mean that you got to enforce it. Really, really, dog, crack. You going to take me to jail for some crack? Like crack. That's what we arrested people for still. Crack cocaine. Not a shipment of crack. I'm talking about my own personal allotment for me. My own, a single rock, a crack. You gonna take me to jail for a crack, sir? That's what you gonna do? It's drugs, dog. It's an addiction. It's not criminal. Drop me off at the Don't Do Crack No More building and go fight the real crime. Because that's how you build the bridge. Because the rift between good cop and bad cop and the argument, it just boils down to who had a good interaction with the police. That's all it boils down to. And if once a month you let go, you are creating allies out the
One of my cousins agrees with this policy.
Well, you know, in a strange way, it's also a little bit of the privileges that we kind of know exist in society, right? I mean, we all have a friend who tell us about something that they got away with, the time that they got pulled over and they just said this and they just did this and the cop let them go.
Yeah.
It just depends on who you are and what you look like and what, you know, sort of who wants to turn the other way.
You know, I just think that, you know, we're in a society where we have to have more people that have had positive interactions that feel genuine and regular and not forced propaganda. Like when you get into the cops playing basketball in the neighborhood or, you know, or when you get into passing out the ice cream. And, you know, and speaking with one of my cousins, the younger cop, you know, his assertion, and this gave me a little bit of perspective, was that more often than not, when the police are doing something that is morally sound, there are no cameras present for that. And there's not a lot of praise there for that. And we're not talking, you know, like, I give you a perfect example. So we did a story about, for the Daily Show, we did a story about ICE deportations that were happening in a neighborhood in Jersey.
We're looking for people who look undocumented. What do they look like?
It's not really any type of particular
right there,
look.
That.
We don't know.
What about that? Right
we don't
there?
Know. We don't know that, right?
So then we got to pull them over. We got to talk to them.
For what?
Through the course of that. We met a local cop who was part of the people that are pushing back against this federal thing that's coming in and ruining a lot of the brown community in this New Jersey town. And just in casual chit chat, you find out, oh yeah, this cop coaches a baseball team for free on the side between shifts. And it's like straight mentoring half the neighborhood. And it's like, that's the stuff that a camera should be pointed at as well to help give, you know, some degree, you know, of perspective so that it doesn't feel like that. To me, that's not performative because that's your time. You are really invested in people.
You mentioned allyship in kind of a funny context about police. And we've talked a little bit about this, but what is an appropriate allyship? How can people express that in a meaningful way, not just a virtue signaling way?
I think it's just about educating yourself on what people are going through and immersing yourself in those worlds. So it could be something as Googling and reading a book. It could be something as simple as volunteering somewhere. It could be something as simple as educating yourself on more programs that you could be a part of. You know, it's not a t-shirt and money. That's part of it. You know, I'm not saying don't wear your shirts because that's also an important message to other people that are in your community that aren't even thinking about the things that you're thinking about. So, you know, I'm not saying go home for Thanksgiving and pop in Selma and then Roots and then when they see us, but you know, if conversations come up and the opportunities start presenting themselves about, yeah, they're voting and trying to put all that black history in the history books. Well, that's just history. Not black history, it's just history. You know, so I think having those conversations, and I joke about that in the special about how don't talk to your black friends about race, talk to your forefathers. And so that's just kind of a tongue-in-cheek way of saying, talk about this to the people in your community, because they're the ones that are going to be disseminating back out into the world and interacting with us, and you want them to be a little more educated. Create more use.
The special is called Imperfect Messenger. It's on Comedy Central now. Roy Wood Jr., thank you so much.
Thank you.
An education and a conversation that never ends. And finally tonight, the United States is now open. That is right, the day that so many have been waiting for has actually arrived. Vaccinated international travelers are now being welcomed into the country after a long 20 months of video calls, missed birthdays, and virtual weddings. Take a listen to one man who just landed at JFK Airport.
No longer on a screen, it's going to be hugs, it's going to be in-person catching up, a lot of stories to tell.
Airports around America are full to the brim with excitement and relief as family and friends finally reunite. And that is it for now. Thank you for watching and goodbye from London.